The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Good morning. Thank you all for coming. And I wanted to first thank Reverend Master Mayon for the opportunity to do this talk. I also wanted to thank Reverend Master Jiyu for my being here. So I thought we would think a little bit today about the ceremony of letting go and also give some thought to moving out of our comfort zone. And I think that our festival of Baisajaguru is a wonderful one for looking at how we actually make use of the Dharma. With all of the invocations, all of the teachings that the Dharma is the medicine for all suffering, and as any good physician will tell you, and I believe it is somewhere in the scriptures that the Buddha said this, I can offer you the medicine, but you're the one that has to take it. And whether you choose to take it or not is up to you, and whether you take it as prescribed or how you choose is up to you. So I think we need to take... So if we accept the fact that the Dharma is the medicine for our suffering, then we need to look, don't we, at what our suffering is. We need to let ourselves get, I believe, probably out of date now, up close and personal with what causes our suffering. And so we need to focus on our thoughts. We need to focus on what we say, what we think, and what we do, because that's the way we manifest our karma. You know, feelings are the reaper of karma, and feelings, so we think, are what cause us to do what we do and say what we say. And actually, put that way, it seems as though we have no control over it, right? But actually, we have a lot of control over it, because we can either choose to go with what we're thinking and feeling, or we can run it past some wonderful reminders that we have, the three pure precepts, the three refuges, the 10 great precepts, and is what I'm thinking, feeling, and about to do in accord with the Dharma, or is it going to cause me more suffering? So we have to look very deeply at what our suffering is. And I guess I would like to focus not so much on the physical suffering that we will all endure or are enduring. You know, the aches, pains of birth, old age, disease, and death. And as I get older, they're becoming more, jumping up and down and claiming my attention. I'd like to focus on what we think and feel and say. I like to focus on the unsatisfactoriness that comes to us in our daily life, the feelings that we have when our critical mind takes over, when the anger comes up, when the jealousy comes up, when the things aren't going our way come up. And I say this to offer today because this is the way I view it, and I'm assuming I'm not such a unique individual that none of you will also have some of this stuff to deal with. We're often told to let go of our suffering, just let go. And I think, that's wonderful, but how do we let go? How do we let go? And this very topic came up for discussion at our recent offering, the offering of lay practice retreat, which was led by Rimester Kodo. And there's a question that came up during the discussions, and the question was, is there a ceremony for letting go? And I thought that was such a wonderful question, because maybe there is a ceremony for letting go, and then when we get stuck, we can just do the ceremony and we've let go, and we can move on with the things we'd like to move on with. And so I thought a lot about that, and I was really helped in this by, when I started pondering, well, how do we do that? How do we let go of our suffering? What is the ceremony of letting go of our suffering? And I realized that the big question for me wasn't looking at the ceremony, a ceremony, if there is one, of how do I let go of my suffering, but what do I need to let go of? And what am I holding on to? And I started listing what I was holding on to, and it grew into a very, very long list, and I'm not going to read it to you now because we all want to get to tea at some point. But some of the things that were on it, I guess the practice works, I'm not even too embarrassed to say this, was liking things my way, having things done the right way, which, interesting enough, coincides with the way I think they should be done. Being right all the time. Although I've gotten to the point in my practice where I'm willing to be wrong a little bit of the time and right most of the time. And I'm hoping that sometime in the next few years, if I last that long and before I die, maybe my practice will get to the point where I can say it doesn't matter whether I'm right. It doesn't matter whether I'm right. I haven't gotten there yet, and I'm still working on it. What was really helpful for me was remembering an article that I had read, I thought, a few years ago in the Journal of the Order of Buddhist Contemplatives, and it turns out it was an article written in 2004 by Reverend Alicia Rowe, and it was called The Comfort Zone. And I read that at the time, and I thought, I never thought about it that way. That's really quite good. And I was kind of appalled to realize that it was written 11 years ago. I still remember what she said, but I can't really say that I've put a lot of it into practice. So I thought it was time to review it. And when I did, I thought, this is something I'd like to share with you. So I'm going to read to you a few passages that Reverend Alicia succinctly wrote out. And she describes what her view of the comfort zone is. And maybe this will be familiar to some of you. Most of us will go to great lengths to avoid situations that scare us or make us uncomfortable in any way and try instead to fill our lives with pleasant objects and activities. For example, most people dislike conflict. Some are prepared to deal with it. Others avoid it as best they can. And some folks are so afraid of it that their lives revolve around keeping everyone pacified and happy. We tend to avoid situations we feel we can't cope with and anything that makes us feel that we aren't good enough. Some of us fear to be alone, and some of us fear to be with others. Whatever the unknown is for us, it is a scary place. And most of us don't like to be in scary places. And I think that's why we find the distractions that we do for our suffering and our discomfort and our dis-ease, because we don't want to be in a scary place. We don't want to look at the messy bits of ourselves, so we kind of keep them in a dark corner and we figure that at some time in our life when we're enlightened Buddhas, it will all dissolve and we won't have to deal with it. But that may not happen in this lifetime. It may. And so recognizing that scary places in our interior selves are simply the places that we need to look at, and they're the places that we need to deal with. And that's what the Dharma gives us, are ways to look at and deal with those scary places. She continues, on the other hand, there are particular conditions and activities that we find pleasant and agreeable. We may simply enjoy them when we can, or we may have a rather driven attitude towards them. And she cites an example of, all of us obviously seek after as good a health as we can. Great Master Dogen says we have only one body in this lifetime, and we owe it respect. And I have certainly known people, and probably sometimes tended on that side myself, where, well, this is good, but a little more would be better. And the example is sufficient rest and relaxation is considered desirable, but has our 8 hours a night become sacred? Good question. Do we live for our favorite activities? Reading, listening to music, TV, shopping, sports? I had a lay trainee tell me one time, I'm meditating 8 hours a day, do you think that's enough? And it was a very challenging question to me, and we talked about that. So we can go overboard one way or the other. It doesn't have to be in indulgent worldly activities. We all like to do things that we can be successful at, and we like it when we feel confident, when we feel relaxed, and when we feel in control. However, if we approach life by trying to live in the comfort zone, this will also be how we approach meditation and spiritual practice. We will want it to feel good. We will want to feel clear and confident about what we are doing. We will want to see signs of success, and we will want to know where we are going. And when we take up Buddhist practice, we have to be willing to let go of knowing where we're going. We have to be willing to, at some point, I think the sooner the better, we have to be willing to leap off of that 80-foot cliff. We have to be willing to jump into the unknown, because if we don't, if we're not willing to do that, we will never get to looking at those scary places inside of ourselves. And that's the whole, for me, the whole purpose of Buddhist training and meditation, is to be able to help me get out of that comfort zone and recognize that comfort is not the end-all, be-all of life. It's simply one aspect of it. I'm always amazed and encouraged by the increasing number of stories that we hear and read of women, and I'm sure there are men, but mostly women with breast cancer and other kinds of cancers that have gone through surgeries and chemo and radiation and will say, that was the best experience in my whole life. And the reason, when you read their stories, that it was the best experience is because it made them stop and it made them look at their own lives, it made them look at their relations with their families. And ultimately, I've never read one that didn't say that, it made them realize how precious life is and how grateful they were for the things that they had. And that's always been a lesson to me, and it's always been inspiring. So instead of looking elsewhere for our comfort, we need to look deeply inside ourselves. I liked some of the conclusions that Reverend Alicia drew about this, and she says, living in the comfort zone has major drawbacks to it. For one thing, it takes a lot of maintenance. It takes a lot of maintenance, right? You're always on the alert for threats to your comfort, and we're having to take evasive action when something threatens. You know, what do you mean the coffee machine isn't working this morning? You know, instead of saying, oh, well, coffee machine's not working this morning. But how will I get through the day? Oh, well, okay, I'll get through the day somehow. So it goes from mundane things like that to much, much larger things. If we're not comfortable, we want to get comfortable. And if we're comfortable, we end up being afraid we're going to lose it in some way. So the comfort zone is also a very self-centered place, because what's comfortable for me may not be comfortable for you. And if I cherish and hold on to my comfort, then I have to say to myself, whether I realize it or not, that the focus is on me. The focus is on me. And especially on my comfort and my gratification. And the wider picture and the long-term view, which includes all of you, simply isn't there. So it takes a lot of maintenance. Living in the comfort zone keeps us from looking at the very, very thing that we need to look at, because the thing we need to look at is something we haven't looked at before, and it's unknown territory. And that's not comfortable, going into unknown territory. She says, most damaging of all is the fact that we cannot grow. When we live in the comfort zone, it's familiar, we know what's there, and we're not going to grow. And she says, we're like a bonsai tree. We're kept from developing so that it can fit into a very tiny space. So you can stay in your comfort zone if you want to stay in a very tiny space. But if you'd like something larger, you have to be willing to step out of it. You have to be willing to go into the unknown. And she concludes by saying, if we look carefully, we will see that at the root of all of our discomfort is fear and doubt. And fear manifests as anything from mild anxiety, most of us know that one, to full-blown panic. And either a few of us know that a lot and often, or a lot of us know it a few times. But whatever, I think we've all been there. She says that depression, embarrassment, guilt, and inadequacy, all of these have fear and doubt as their root. And this really spoke to me, because when I started really looking at the anger that seem to be arising more often, and from hindsight, perhaps that was the case because I was finally ready to look at it, and I found, much to my surprise and chagrin, that it came from fear. It came from fear of not having things the way I wanted them, not having things the way they, quote, should be. And it was very unsettling, because I had always thought, gosh, with all of my activities of hiking and climbing and rafting, I was a pretty fearless person. And then I came to the monastery and had all these other monk mirrors around to look in and see my reflection in. And I thought, I think I'll just go sit in the corner and hide my head. But that doesn't work for more than a couple of minutes. It gives you a little relief, but it's not the answer. And the answer is being willing to look at the fear and the doubt that arises in us, whatever the cause may be. She makes an interesting observation. It is because fear and doubt are the fundamental states of all beings who perceive themselves as separate from the rest of the universe. So when we perceive ourselves as separate, we allow the fear and doubt to arise. And you don't have to have studied Buddhism very long to have come across the all is one and all is different. One of the teachings that I remember most vividly from Reverend Master Jiyu, that all is one and all is different. There is no separation. But as long as we remain ignorant of our oneness with all existence, and I continue to refer to Reverend Alicia's article, we will fear loss and we will doubt our adequacy. Those were helpful teachings for me to reflect on, to look at the comfort zone as a way of having a barrier between ourselves and other people, between the me and the you. And if meditating for these years and trying to keep the precepts has taught me anything, it's that I don't want to be in my dying days thinking of me and you. I want to be able to think of us and we. And when I was thinking of this, I thought, you know, it's really interesting because if you take the word me, the M-E, and you turn it upside down, you get W-E, which is the opposite of me. So you can look at me and say, well, all I need to do is turn myself upside down, and I'll be able to see the we in all of us. So those were some reflections that come from that wonderful article. And so, of course, it brings up the question of, well, how do I, as an individual, with my own karma, my own genetic predispositions, my own upbringing, where I am in life, how do I let go of my fear and doubt? And that's what brought me back to the ceremony of letting go. Because I thought, if I could find a nice little ceremony that every time the fear and doubt arose, I could just say, oh, right. And so I started thinking about the ceremony of letting go. And when I did, interesting enough, I found numerous ceremonies of letting go. And so I'm going to read you my list, or at least some of it. There's the ceremony of Gassho, putting the left and the right hand together, pointing upward. There was a wonderful lecture given by a senior monk when I was a very young novice that talked about the meaning of the Gassho. And obviously we don't have time to go into all that, but when I think of it as bringing the opposites together, you know, I can also think of it as here's me and here's the rest of the world. And the closer we get, there's going to come to a point where there isn't any space between us. So there's all is one, there's still all is different, there's a left hand and a right hand. But when we perform the ceremony of the Gassho, we are helping to resolve that barrier. There's the ceremony of formal meditation, just being willing to just sit with no place to go and nothing to do. Isn't that wonderful? How often can you say that in your busy life out there in the world? No place to go and nothing to do. It's the ceremony of formal meditation. there's a ceremony of ceremonies, and we just did one. We did a wonderful one. It wasn't perfect, as some of you may have noticed. There were a few little glitches here and there. Some of us wondered, which way should we go? Should I bow now? Should I bow later? But it doesn't matter. What matters is that we all did it together. And that's the point, or one of the points, of ceremony for me, is that we all do it together as a Sangha. And we offer the respect and the blessings and the merit of that ceremony to each other and to all beings. There's the ceremony of mindfulness, of just simply being mindful. And when we find that we're distracted, bringing ourselves back to where we are. We can do this all the time in our everyday life. So the question to ask yourself every once in a while throughout the day, particularly if you find yourself getting just a little tight or a little headachy or a little grumpy, is to say, am I being mindful? Where's my mind at? And just ask yourself that. That's the ceremony of mindfulness. There is obviously, and I won't go into them, the ceremony of keeping the precepts, the ceremony of walking the Eightfold Path. There's the ceremony of studying the Four Noble Truths. And there's the ceremony of forgiveness. Can I, having recognized the awfulness that someone, quote, did to me deliberately to make me unhappy, can I forgive that person? Can I forgive the circumstances that are causing me to be grumpy when I don't want to be grumpy, and it's no fault of my own? Obviously, there are some difficulties in that attitude. And one of the things that helps when we find that attitude in ourselves is to forgive ourselves. Not just to forgive other people, but to forgive ourselves for what we think and what we say and what we feel. There's the attitude of bowing. There's the attitude of bowing. We did that this morning, and as you may have noticed, some of us are able to do full prostrations on the floor and get up very gracefully. Some of us do full prostrations on the floor and get up a little less gracefully. Some of us don't do full prostrations on the floor, but the bowing comes from your heart. There's a wonderful, see if I can find it for you very quickly. There's an article, again in the journal, in the spring 2013 issue, and it's by Reverend Alina Burgess, and it's called Bowing to What Comes. Bowing to What Comes. You know, this morning when we bowed towards the altar. But actually, what we bowed to was the wisdom of the Buddhas and ancestors, the compassion of the teaching. And so, in this particular article, Reverend Alina talks about bowing to whatever comes. And she quotes Reverend Master Daishin Morgan in his book, Sitting Buddha, the first thing is always to bow, because bowing is the outer action of the inner intent to let go of everything. There's a very comprehensive article on bowing by Reverend Master Miho Harris at Place of Peace Dharma Refuge in Wales, and it's in the summer issue of the journal. And I would recommend it to you if you sort of are thinking, well, you know, bowing's just not my thing, and I'm happy to do it when I come to the Abbey or Throstle and or any of the priories and do it because everybody else does it, but it doesn't have a lot of meaning for me. It's a very wonderful article. Reverend Alina's article looks towards bowing to whatever happens to us. Can we bow to whatever comes. And I thought that was a wonderful way of looking at letting go. Because when we bow, we let go of the self. When all is offered up, this is again a quote by Reverend Master Daishin Morgan, when all is offered up, there is deep, unobstructed freedom to do that which is good. Sometimes when I have been bowing and thinking, oh, wish I could get down on the floor and do a full bow, and when I'm able to let that go, and I simply bow my head and raise my hands, there's this wonderful, wonderful little moment of, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how deeply I can bow physically. What matters is bowing. And I thought that Reverend Alina captured it very well when she said, it's important to see that this is freedom not to be willful, but to naturally respond to that which calls us to do that which is good as far as we can see. I think when we bow to whatever comes our way, it's a way of letting go. And so for me, the ceremony of bowing is a great deal of my ability to let go. And it also helps to see what it is I need to do. The other ceremony that I came up with, or that came to me, I don't really think I had much to do with this. You just sit down and you say, what's needed here, was the ceremony of gratitude. And that's been, as we tend to say, a work in progress for me. Some time back, when I felt that I was having a great deal of difficulty with the critical mind and with judgment of both myself and others, I decided maybe I would try practicing gratitude. And I thought, well, how does one practice gratitude in your daily life, for heaven's sakes? And I thought I could say thank you. And at some point in my life, I kind of gave up saying thank you and please, because that's what everyone did when I was growing up in the South, and I didn't feel anyone really meant it. And I didn't want to be a hypocrite. I wanted to really know that when I said thank you, I meant it. And when I said please, I meant it. So I just gave the whole thing up. And I think now that was a bad move. So I decided, well, how could I say thank you? And one of the things I had to be willing to do was to start this practice without having a feeling inside of gratitude, but recognizing that saying thank you is a form of expressing gratitude. And whether it, quote, felt authentic or not, I could go ahead and do it. So I started keeping a little gratitude journal. And at the end of the day, I would write down all the times that I said thank you. And I thought, that's not bad, twice. That's not too bad. And fortunately, as time and the years went on, it got to be a few more than that, you know. I think it even got up to 27 one time. I thought that was pretty nice. And no matter what the number was, the next morning when I got up, I would look at that and I say, okay, I said thank you two times yesterday. I'm going to try to say thank you three times today. And so that was my morning and evening ceremony of gratitude, was saying, how did I do today? Not too bad. Getting up in the morning and saying, how can I do a little better? How can I do a little better? And I found myself in the shower last night, and the showers for the water for the Bodhidharma Hall, as I understand it, it can be either from our wood-fired boiler or from the solar panels. So you never know who's providing you the water, but there's usually hot water there. So I was taking this shower, and I was very, very tired, and I was very, very achy. And I uttered out loud, oh, this feels so good. This feels so good. And then I thought, aren't we lucky to have hot water, because we're we're trying to get the tank is drained and we're trying to get it rewelded, and so we're relying on our solar panels. And I thought, oh, isn't it wonderful that we have the solar panels and I have hot water to make me feel better? And then I thought, wasn't it wonderful that our wonderful extern sacrosants put in those pipes from the boiler over here? And then I thought, oh, and isn't it wonderful that they had this and that and the other thing? And I got back to the solar panels and I got back to the sun. And you know, it didn't end. It didn't end. It did end because I had to stop my shower and go do other things. But what didn't end was how wide and expansive the things were that provided me with that hot water. And there was a little instant, it may have been a second, it may have been less than a second, where I was aware of how much went in to giving me a hot shower. And for an instant, just for a little tiny instant, there wasn't a me there. There was just all of those other things providing Scholastica with this healing hot water and shower. And I thought, oh, I guess the practice really works, doesn't it? If you keep at it, the practice works. So all of what I said leads me to the final ceremony, which of course will be a lifetime of work, which is the ceremony of no separate self. It's recognizing that if we have an aim and a goal, that's what it is to recognize that we are truly one with all beings. It's allowing the little self to dissolve into the greater self. It's the no self of no eye, no ear, no tongue, no body, mind, no form, no taste, no sound, no color, no touch, no object. Void, all is void, unstained, and pure. I want to close with a Dogen quote. I was working with one of our lay congregation the other day on a little writing project, or a big writing project, and we were trying to remember the exact wording of a Dogen quote. And I thought, I know where that is. And so I went to Zen is Eternal Life, and I went to Genjo Koan, and I thought, I've been here before, and I'm going to read you the whole quote. When one studies Buddhism, one studies oneself. When one studies oneself, one forgets oneself. All of the ceremonies of letting go, all of the sitting in meditation is studying oneself. And that's when one forgets oneself. When one forgets oneself, one is enlightened by everything. And this very enlightenment breaks the bonds of clinging to both body and mind, not only for oneself, but for all beings as well. So please let us remember that we train for self and we train for others. The three pure precepts, cease from evil, do only good, and do good for others, is sometimes translated as purifying your heart. And for me, this is the ceremony of daily life. The no separate self, this is the big ceremony, purifying my heart. So that whatever comes or doesn't come, I can bow and I can say, thank you. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.